You're listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is all about COVID immunity and nutrition. There's been a lot of coverage of the potential of vitamins to help fight against COVID-19. Our immune system is our first line of defense when it comes to viruses. Is there a way that we can strengthen our own immunity to make us less susceptible to disease? Now, joining us to discuss this is Philip Calder, Professor of Nutritional Immunology, School of Human Development and Health, Faculty of Medicine at the University of Southampton. Good morning, Philip. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Now, last May, you led a review into the role of nutrition in immunity and host susceptibility to COVID-19. And that was updated in the autumn as well. And we talked to you about 8 months ago or so. Now, but before we go into the detail about the review and about what we've learned, could you just briefly talk us through the immune system? What do we mean by it? What does it do?
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. So the immune system is our defense system. It's how we defend ourselves, so cope with the presence of dangerous organisms, particularly microorganisms, by which I mean bacteria and viruses that we might encounter. So it's our way of identifying and dealing with those threats.
And has our understanding of the immune system changed significantly over the last few years?
Well, immunology is a wonderful science which is always progressing. So we know much more about the types of cells that are involved in our immune system and our immune defenses, how they work. There are many different subtleties amongst how those different cells are working, the chemical messages they produce, the way they communicate with one another. So we're always progressing in our understanding of immunity, that's for sure.
And when we talk about our adaptive immune system, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we have different branches of the immune system, if you like, and one of them is called the adaptive, sometimes it's called the acquired immune response. And what that word adaptive or acquired means is components of our immune system actually change according to the nature of an infection. So in other words, our immune system adapts to the presence of a bacterium or a virus. So it changes the way it works and it behaves in a very specific manner to the pathogen. So that's what the adaptive immune system is all about. It's about adapting to specific organisms and making sure that we can defend ourselves properly against those.
And things like this are very much at the forefront of people's minds at the moment with COVID. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the story of the review that you made last May? Because there was a big update in autumn, and there have been lots of questions that have been thrown around about the role of vitamins in immunity. What's the story? What did you first discover in May that surprised you? And how has our understanding developed since then?
Yeah, so it's been known for a long time that many different lifestyle factors influence people's immune systems, and one of those is diet. So there's already a lot of information out there about aspects of diet, about specific nutrients, and the way they work to support the immune system in going about its business, so they support immune function. So there's plenty of literature there. So what I did back in spring, early summer of last year, was I gathered together the data that exists on specific micronutrients, that is vitamins and minerals, and their roles in supporting different aspects of both innate and adaptive immunity, just put together the idea that thinking about these micronutrients could be important in the context of what was then a new viral pandemic. Now, at the time I wrote the review, there was very little data actually on COVID-19 and nutrition.
It was really early days, wasn't it?
It was pretty early on, actually. I think I wrote it about April time. So we didn't really know much about specific nutrients or nutrition in general and COVID-19. Of course, a lot of people did a lot of research over the course of the last 10 months or so. So now there are plenty of papers looking at the possibility that specific nutrients might play a role in helping our immune systems protect us against coronavirus, or maybe even can be useful in treating people once they are already infected. So the updates in these reviews are really trying to capture the emerging science specifically around particularly vitamins and minerals and COVID-19.
And what were the most important changes in our understanding, do you think?
So we already know, because scientists have been looking at this actually for decades, that some vitamins vitamins A, C, D, and E, and also the B vitamins are important. And some minerals, particularly zinc, but also selenium, iron, copper, and one or two others, are important in supporting many components of the immune system, both the innate components and the adaptive components. So we knew all of that already, and we knew something about the importance of those nutrients in supporting antiviral defenses. So the research in the COVID era, if I can call it that, has really been measuring the levels of those nutrients in people's blood and relating that to whether they're infected or not and how severe the infections are. So these are what we call association studies, relating blood levels of nutrients with the presence or the severity of COVID-19. So there's plenty of studies now associating, for example, low vitamin D status, low zinc status, low selenium status with severity of COVID-19. I think this is really important research and important data, but we have to keep in mind these are what I'm calling association studies, so simply relating low levels of those nutrients to the presence of more severe COVID-19. And really to prove that these nutrients are really vital, we need trials where we give people the nutrients and see what the effect is. And so far, we don't really have many of those sorts of studies in COVID-19. So we have progressed, but we haven't really got as far as we need to make really strong statements.
Yeah. So very recently, the BMJ said that there's insufficient evidence to support taking vitamin C solely to prevent or to treat COVID-19. But the NHS website says, I'm looking at it right this very second, actually, and we are in towards the end of February. And it says that if you're vulnerable, then you should be taking vitamin D supplements. There's been a lot of talk about vitamin D, a lot of it in the press. And I'm not sure if you feel that people have jumped on this as some sort of cure for COVID simply because science journalists are a little bit lazy. What's your view on the reporting about vitamin D?
Yeah, so what's clear is that there are plenty of these what I've called association studies between low vitamin D status and severity of COVID-19. There are probably 40, 50, maybe even more of these publications reporting this. So the association studies are actually pretty consistent. As I mentioned, what we don't have really are good trials where people have been given vitamin D in an effort to either prevent or treat COVID-19, although there are a few studies where that has happened, and there are some suggestions that might help. But I think the evidence is a bit slim right now. And we have to be careful not to let the enthusiasm overweigh the reality of the evidence. I mean, there's no doubt that all of these micronutrients I mentioned, all of these vitamins and minerals are essential for life and are important in supporting the immune system. But I wouldn't think that any one of them alone would be the magic bullet, for sure. But, you know, they will each play their individual role. And, you know, at this time, you know, small effects can be important in some people, I think.
And so is there any nutritional advice that consumers can take from this? Or does it just relate back to the idea of have a good varied diet, eat mainly fruit and veg and make it fresh and make it yourself if you can? Is there more, something more specific than that we can give people?
Yeah, so I think you've summed it up pretty well. So the nutrients I'm talking about, obviously we get them in foods, and we get them through a diverse and varied diet with lots of plant-based foods, so fruits, vegetables, seeds, nuts, pulses, and so on, berries, but also some animal foods, because some of the nutrients we're talking about, like vitamin D, for example, you know, the best source actually is oily fish. Omega-3s, which are also important in the immune system, again, oily fish is really important. Vitamin B12, you know, meat is the main source. So I think we need a blend of some animal-based foods along with a pretty strong plant-based diet. There remains the question about vitamin D, which you already asked. And, you know, the government does recommend that people use, let's call it a low-dose vitamin D supplement, because it's so hard to get enough vitamin D from our diets. Mm. Things like fortified cereals and so on can be really important sources of some of these vitamins and minerals. So, you know, those are the sorts of things you might want to incorporate, you know, fortified whole grain cereals for breakfast, for example, can be important.
Do you feel that there's a sense of vindication that all of the studies that have looked at nutrition and COVID-19 kind of come back to these essential bits of advice that everyone has been really relying on for the last few years?
So our dietary advice is based on judgments around scientific evidence, and that evidence comes from many different aspects of nutritional science, including relationships between food intake and health outcome, but also knowledge of the impact of specific nutrients on processes in the body. And when you understand about the relationship between the nutrients in the foods and then the effects on health outcomes, you make the recommendations or guidelines. So, you know, the healthy eating guidelines are based on evidence, and they apply, you know, for cardiovascular protection. They apply to support good metabolism, and they apply to support good immune function. So I don't think there's anything magical about a nutritional recommendation for supporting immunity, because I have the view that the same nutrients are pretty important for all bodily functions, including the immune system.
Mm. And to what extent would this change, you know, would bad nutrition compared to good nutrition, you know, somebody who doesn't get a decent balance of micronutrients, what sort of level of risk, of raised risk, would you say that they're putting themselves to?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think it's pretty clear that less healthy diets result in greater risk of what we call non-communicable diseases than more healthy diets. So what by that I mean things like you know, heart disease, some cancers, you know, maybe other functional declines in the body. And, you know, the risk attributed to poor diet for some of these actually can be quite high. So, you know, it may be as high as, you know, a 20 or even more, 20-30% contribution to risk of heart disease, for example, with a poorer diet compared to a better diet. Now, as far as the immune system is concerned, I think it's really difficult to make that judgment because the data isn't sort of digested in or distilled in the same way as for the non-communicable diseases like heart disease. But I think because poorer diets, less healthy diets, will be delivering less of these vital vitamins and minerals, then poorer diets are associated with poorer immune function, and that would increase people's risk of being unable to deal with infections, be they bacterial or viral.
So just stepping away from the data and a kind of a rational view of how it works, you must be flipping furious that people don't actually take on this information and change the way that they eat.
I think it's frustrating to many people in both the science and the policy of nutrition that the healthy eating guidelines are well-founded in evidence, but are often poorly adhered to. But we have to think about the factors that maybe impair people's ability to follow a really healthy diet and indeed other aspects of lifestyle. So things like, poor access to really healthy foods and those sorts of things, the importance of socioeconomic status. On the other hand, I do think some of the things that we know have happened during the last 10 months are a bit encouraging. So I think, two things have happened as far as people's diets are concerned. One is for some people, actually, it's become more difficult maybe to access good quality food because, lots of shops have been closed. It's been more difficult for people to get around and so on. There's the economic impact of not being able to work. So I think for some people, it's probably been harder to access good quality diets.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we do know that at least for some people, there was sort of increased activity around, for example, growing your own food at home. I've heard about some of that greater growing of vegetables in the garden, for example. And also a lot of people, I think, started more home cooking. Partly because they had a little bit more time on their hands. So there were some good things. And also, I think the COVID pandemic has confronted people with something of huge health significance, which is right in their face. And this is very different from the long-term consequences of things like heart disease or cognitive decline or cancer. And I think when you have a health challenge right in front of you, for some people at least, this is like a wake-up call, and they will look for ways of helping themselves to improve lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen this around physical activity. So we know a lot of people are doing more physical activity, some indoors, again, partly because of more time, and also because, lockdown, people feel like they need a bit of physical activity. So I think as far as diet is concerned, there are some pros and cons from the last 10 months as far as people moving towards more healthy aspects of eating is concerned.
Mm. Now, if we look at a few specifics, what about the effect of aging on our immune system? And is there an impact on changing nutritional needs as we grow older?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as we know, as people age, there are a lot of functional declines. So the ones that are most obvious are probably the musculoskeletal decline. So, people become less able to move around, and they become slower in their walking and what have you. Physical activity becomes harder. The other, of course, is cognitive decline. People's cognition loses some of its effectiveness. So these are the obvious functional declines of aging, but the immune system also declines with aging. Now, there are several reasons for this. One is that our immune cells are produced in bone marrow, and it seems as we age, the export of new immune cells from the bone marrow decreases. Some cells of adaptive immunity, the T cells or T lymphocytes, they actually go from bone marrow to an organ called the thymus, which sits a little bit above the heart, and they mature in the thymus. And as we age, actually the thymus shrinks and there's decreased output of new T cells into the bloodstream. So we have fewer new cells coming out into the bloodstream as we age. And the cells that we already have actually lose their function. Just like our muscles lose their function with aging, actually our immune cells lose their function. So we have fewer new cells and the cells we have don't work so well. And what that means is older people have immune impairments, are particularly frail older people and malnourished older people. And we know that those sorts of older people are at greater risk of infections. And COVID-19, particularly in the first 6 to 8 months of the pandemic, really hit older people much, much more than younger adults, middle-aged adults. So older people were at easily the greatest risk, particularly those living in care homes and frail people in the community. So I think that is explained quite well by the age-related immune impairment with aging, particularly frailty. So what that means from a nutritional context is, you know, there is a nutritional vulnerability in older people that we need to take notice of. Some of that is related to, you know, loss of muscle, which in part relates to protein intake and physical activity. Mm-hmm. And some of it relates to intake of vitamins and minerals. And we know a good proportion of older people have lower intakes of vitamins and minerals than they should. Again, some of that relates to inability to access the foods that provide those nutrients, but also other things like, you know, older people have difficulty, you know, in chewing and swallowing. Often they lose their desire to eat, those sorts of things. So older people are really vulnerable to nutrient deficiencies and onset of frailty. And alongside that, they have immune impairments. And I think those two things are at least partly related to one another. I wouldn't say poor nutrition was the sole explanation of age-related immune impairment, but I think it is a contributor to that process or accelerates
closely connected.
It.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And is the same true for people with underlying health conditions? The same connection between nutrition and the immune system is as powerful?
Yeah. I think almost as powerful because the effect in older people is quite well described because they're known to be vulnerable. You know, we know older people suffer influenza every year more so than younger adults. This is not quite so clear in people with other you know, health vulnerabilities. I think the one that came out pretty early on in the coronavirus pandemic was, you know, people with obesity. Because the doctors noticed pretty quickly that as well as older people, the other group that seemed to be a bit overrepresented with severe COVID-19 was people with obesity.
Yeah.
And it is already described in the literature, although perhaps not as widely known as the effects of aging, that people with obesity also have immune impairments. They're also known to be more susceptible to influenza as well. So I think obesity is an immune or creates an immune vulnerability in the same way that aging does.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Probably other, you know, health conditions, underlying health conditions that predispose some people to COVID-19 probably also involve some immune impairments. But, you know, there may be other things like respiratory impairments, for example, that also contribute to vulnerability.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question that will sound really annoying, I'm sure, to a scientist. But for the person wandering around the supermarket, is there some broad nutritional advice that you can give them to be eating to help them stave off COVID-19? Or is I know that it's not as simple as that, but is there some useful information we can give people as they're trying to make their food choices?
Yeah, so we've already, I think, touched on this a couple of times. So remember, our immune system is there to defend us. So we know that there are some nutrients that support the immune system in working well. And we've talked about the various vitamins, minerals, and what have you. And we've also talked about the fact that many plant foods are good sources of lots of these vitamins and minerals, although they're not all of them. So I think, you know, a good selection of fruits, vegetables, berries, you know, nuts, pulses, and so on is pretty important. I mentioned things like oily fish and, you know, some meats to provide nutrients that plants are not so good at providing. I mentioned fortified foods, including cereals. So these are, you know, here I'm focusing on ways to deliver the things we need.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
we need to balance that up with making choices that provide us with too much of the things we don't need, and sort of making room for, let's say, a bit more fruit and veg. So I think, you know, we should also focus on, you know, less of the processed foods, which are rich in, you know, fat, especially saturated fat, in simple sugars, sometimes in salt, because those are things which the body doesn't need in excess. And that includes the immune system, actually. So we know from animal studies that, you know, too much fat is harmful to the immune system. There are interesting studies on simple sugars and immunity also. So I think replacing some of the things that, you know, people probably know have some of these less healthy nutritional attributes and making that up with, you know, just a little bit more fruit and veg perhaps would be a good strategy. And you already mentioned yourself, I think, you know, focusing on the fresh rather than the pre-prepared and processed, I think, can be a good thing.
Yeah. Now, over the last couple of years, we've seen a huge explosion in the growth of the plant-based food market, lots of vegan foods, as well as vegetarian foods. Now, I know we talked about the fact that you do need... you know, that meat is a fantastic source of vitamin D, but also the plant-based food market has sort of changed nutritional profiles for a lot of people as well. Do you think it has helped people in to bolster their immune system by choosing a plant-based diet?
That's a really difficult question to answer. So I think if people elected to adopt the sort of diet I've been talking about, which is more fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, berries, those sorts of things, seeds, nuts, what have you, as a partial replacement for foods that maybe they'd been eating too much of before, like some animal-based foods, like meat, for some meats, for example, that would be a good thing. I think specific foods and meals that have been designed to make it easier for people to adopt vegetarian and vegan lifestyles can be useful, but we have to think about the whole nutritional package presented by those foods. So, for example, simply because a food is suitable for vegetarians or vegans doesn't mean it's especially low in fat, for example. Doesn't mean it's especially low in salt, for example.
Yeah.
So I think we have to adopt our same, our nutritional lens, if you like, when we're looking at foods produced for people who might wish to adopt vegetarian or vegan lifestyles, just as we would use that nutritional lens for people who want an omnivorous diet. But I do think a move towards a more plant-based diet is a good thing from the point of view of health and also the environment.
And just to wind this up a little, is there a very close connection with the gut microbiome? You know, are we back to, you know, the same conversation about feeding the gut microbiome in order to ensure our immune response is as powerful as possible.
Yeah, I think that's part of it for sure. So when I've been talking about vitamins and minerals, I'm really talking about getting those nutrients into people's bodies, that is into their bloodstream, and allowing immune cells to access those nutrients and work better. Another element of nutrition is its impact on the gut microbiota, that is the bacteria particularly that live in the GI tract. And the sort of diet that we've been mentioning several times, which is a strongly plant-based diet, you know, with plenty of fiber and, you know, plant chemicals, is one which seems to promote a sort of a healthy, diverse gut microbiota. So a healthy, diverse diet creates a healthy, diverse gut microbiota. And we know, again, because of research over the last few decades, that there is communication between the gut microbiota and the immune system, and also between the immune system and the gut microbiota. So they're each sort of controlling one another to an extent. And there are some data showing that, you know, a more optimal, if you like, gut microbiota helps to support the immune system better than a poor gut microbiota. So we do have a diet, gut microbiota, immune interaction. And then coming back to some of the factors that we talked about earlier on, older people have altered gut microbiota.
Mm.
People with obesity have altered gut microbiota. So it is, I think, possible that some of the immune impairments associated with aging, associated with obesity, and maybe associated with some other health vulnerabilities around immunity are in part related to having an altered gut microbiota. People sometimes call that dysbiosis, meaning you haven't got your gut microbiota quite right. So I think that is part of the picture here. And therefore, I think, you know, the diet I've been talking about for immune support is also one that actually gives us a healthy, diverse gut microbiota as well. So I think it all makes sense as one joined up sort of view, holistic view, if you like, of microbiota and immunity.
Mm. And just the last question, we're beginning to see some studies being launched where people will be infected with COVID-19. Are you hoping that these will look very much at the nutritional immunology side of how these unfold?
Yeah, I might hope that, but I'm not sure that that will happen. So I think we're really lacking data on the impact of lifestyle factors and immunity in the context of COVID-19. I talked a little bit about emerging data around nutrition, but, you know, other things like, you know, physical activity, stress, all those sorts of things which also impact the immune system, you know, how important they are, sleep, you know, sleep deprivation impairs immunity. So there are lots of lifestyle factors that influence immunity that could be together creating a pattern that makes people more or less susceptible to COVID-19. So I think this is an opportunity to try to gather that sort of data. I think the infection studies will very much focus on, you know, the immunology, which, you know, maybe is right, because at the end of the day, it is the immune system which is the focus here. But I think gathering data on factors that also might be modulating, if you like, mm-hmm. how the immune system is working can be really important in the context of both the challenge studies with coronavirus, but also the vaccinations against COVID-19.
And I guess we can hope that something good comes out of the fact that these will be launched. Maybe we'll understand a lot more about nutrition and the immune system across the board. And at least that would be one good thing to come out of it. Well, Philip, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Philip Calder, Professor of Nutritional Immunology. Now, if you enjoyed this podcast, then you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from plant-based fish to ingredients trends. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Philip, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.